Hello, good afternoon. This is rather fabulous to be in here. I'm Paul Clayton, and I'm the chairman of the Actors' Centre, which, for those of you who don't know about the Actors' Centre, is over the other side of Covent Garden. We've been invited here to bring a series of talks that we do at the Actors' Centre called Off the Record, and we're very grateful to Really Useful Theatres for inviting us over to what has to be probably the grandest and finest room in Covent Garden, certainly. The Actors' Centre is an institution that's been founded over 35 years ago, and it's to support actors at all stages of their career, to help them sustain long and hopefully fruitful careers. We still produce the best actors in the world in Britain, and even in these hard economic times where it costs a young person £27,000 to do 3 years of training, we still produce more actors than any other country in the world. And talking of best actors, I'm allowed now to use a Roald Dahl world and say word and say I'm thrilled to start this series of talks here at Drury Lane with an old friend and quite simply one of our finest theatre actors, as Willy Wonka might say, the shoztastic Mr. Alex Jennings. This is your home, isn't it?
It is my home, actually, yes. Next. yes, it's very nice to be back. I was here about 10 years ago doing Henry Higgins in My Fair Lady, which was one of the happiest times of my career, and it was surprising and alarming to be asked to come into this show.
To come back?
Yeah.
All right, well, let's hear more about your stay here a little bit later. Let's go right back to the beginning. Is there a moment that you identify when it all started?
I suppose once, you could kind of trace it back to how I was as a kid. I'm sure it's the same with kind of all of us who are thespically inclined. of being a bit of a clown when I was a kid, I suppose. We used to go on holidays on the Norfolk Broads, and I spent one entire boating holiday as a German U-boat commander when I was about eight. I used to go to the theatre a bit as I was growing up, not hugely. We used to have family Boxing Day treats to the West End, mostly to musicals.
Where are you now? Where did you?
I was in Essex.
In Essex? Yeah, you're an Essex boy?
I am an Essex boy.
Okay.
I am. And I've sort of acquired a, you know, actorly twang along the way, but my roots are much harder. And a particular teacher at school, who was the economics master, who also ran a drama group outside of lessons, and I got involved in that, and that was it, really. And he was an amazing, he was one of those teachers that changes your life.
Yeah.
His enthusiasm, his personality, extraordinarily influential, and that kind of got me on, and we used to do inter-house competitions, you know,
yeah,
scenes from plays and then proper productions.
And then the National Youth Theatre.
And then the National Youth Theatre, where we met. And before that, I'd got involved in kind of counter youth theatres as well.
Okay.
And I think I got a grant to go to the National Youth Theatre.
Yeah, yeah, we did in those days.
Yeah.
They used to give you grants to do things like that.
Yeah. And I headed off I think I did 3 years with the Youth Theatre. And spent the summers living in London and doing plays.
You cornered the market in Vickers.
I did do quite a lot of Vickers, yeah. One did a striptease in a play by Barry Keith called Up the Truncheon, it was called. There's a very dodgy photo somewhere of myself and Sally Dexter in our underwear. It probably wouldn't be allowed now, would it? How old were we, 17, 16, 17?
Yeah, no, you'd have to be double CRB checked.
You would. But amazingly sort of exciting times. And I'd been, you know, by that point I was going to see masses of stuff as well, often on my own. I'd stand at the back of the Aldwych and the National when it was at the Old Vic. And
you decided then that that's what life was going to be?
Yeah, I had, really. I mean, you know, I toyed with the law. I really didn't, you know, there's no way I could have... I don't know what I'd have done, really.
Okay.
Don't know. And then tried to get into drama school towards the end of UCS. How old are you when you leave school? 18, 19. And I tried for the only ones I'd heard of, which were RADA and Lambda, and didn't get in. And so tried for university as a sort of second best, as I thought, and went to Warwick and read English and theatre studies and spent 3 years doing plays.
And meeting your wife?
And meeting my wife.
So good advantages from going to university?
Yeah. The first show we did together was The Crucible, and she played Betty Paris and had a lot of strapping. And I didn't get a part. I was on stage management, furious, absolutely furious, and used to give very, very sort of camp, drawing attention to myself calls over the tannoy. But we had incredible facilities at Warwick. I mean, a very new then art centre. This is late 70s. Incredible facilities. And Stratford was my local then, so saw everything there.
And you did then go to... You did go and train.
I did. I then did a post-grad course at Bristol, tried for the one-year course, and they said, no, we think you need two. And again, you know, got a lot of financial support from my parents, but got 5 years of grant. Those were the days.
Do you think people should train?
I don't think you have to. It was fantastic for me. I learned a huge amount. I'm very glad I went to university first, because I mixed with people who didn't just want to be actors. So that was, you know, that was just important in my own development. But no, I don't think you have to train at all.
It's a very expensive thing these days now. And of course, there's a big debate that that's ruling out a lot of people having access to training.
Yeah, I think it probably is. And, you know, I haven't read it, but I saw that Judi Dench was talking about, you know, the whole... the financial divide, not allowing poorer kids to go to train, which I'm sure is true. I don't know, you know, it's... I spoke about this in an interview recently when I said that my advice to people who wanted to go into this business would be, because it had been great for me, to go to university first, because of the breadth of that education. And there was some sort of a little bit of minor kind of backlash of, does Alex Jennings not realise how expensive it is? Yes, he does, you know, because I've got kids and they're going through that system and it's $9,000 a year. This isn't the point, but it's also quite a cheap way to borrow money. you may never have to pay it back. I know, you know, that's not the point. I was very, very fortunate.
Yeah. So after that training, where did you go? Where did you have ambitions, or did you just launch into the world saying, I'll do anything that pays?
Yeah, I suppose I did have ambitions. I suppose, you know, I'd not been put off by the fact that I didn't get into drama school first time round.
Yeah.
I got work pretty quickly with a little touring company based in Barnstaple in Devon.
Oh, right.
The Orchard Theatre Company.
Yeah.
Which was driving the van, putting the set up, taking the set down, doing the acting, sleeping in dodgy digs.
It's all that stage management experience from doing The Crucible.
Indeed. And
radio rep?
And then and also did some another TIE company based in Cambridgeshire, neither of which exist anymore. I don't know, you know, how much TIE... the Orchard Theatre Company does still exist. run by Bill Buffery. Old friend of ours from National New Theatre, Bill Buffery, yeah. who's kept it going. How the fuck he's done that, I don't yeah. know. But incredibly important work, I think, to be able to go into schools, even though playing Macbeth at 10 o'clock on a Tuesday morning in a school in Cambridgeshire is... You know.
And also, it's a really brilliant opportunity for when you come out as a young actor, you've got the whole world in front of you, but that is a really realistic and very achievable objective to actually get you on stage day after day doing
yeah.
what you trained to do.
Yes, and it's work.
Yeah,
it's...
which is what it's all about. Mm. You just want to work.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you did do the BBC radio.
I did, yeah, a little bit of telly and you know, tiny bits on telly, and then did a long stint with the BBC radio rep.
Is that just funny voices?
Yes, and there's nothing wrong with that.
No, you're very good at you're very good at funny voices.
A huge influence on my acting style were the films Those Magnificent Men in the Flying Machines.
Okay,
and It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. Yeah, funny voices. Which still come in useful.
Indeed, we might come back to that.
And the radio rep was amazing, actually.
Yeah.
I got to... The variety of work, little readings, big parts in plays, tiny, tiny parts in plays, working with a huge range of performers.
Yeah.
One particular actor was a guy called Godfrey Kenton, who'd played Hamlet at Stratford in the 20s, you know. Extraordinary people, and actors who'd just done radio. Great skills and variety of performers and variety of work, which has sort of stood me in good stead, because that's been a kind of... very fortunate that that's been a sort of seam in my work, mm-hmm. I suppose, of doing radio and doing audio books and stuff.
And then after that, I know there's other things, so I'm skipping a little bit, but then you went to Chichester.
Yeah.
The Scarlet Pimpernel?
Yeah, the Scarlet Pimpernel with the great late Donald Sinden.
Oh, yes.
Which was... I'd gone to Chichester, I went on a... I'd been acting for about 5 or 6 years, I think. 5 years, it was 1985, and I was rather grumpy because it was a player's cast contract, and I was sort of slightly reluctant about doing it because I thought I'd got beyond that, but I hadn't. And I was on the same contract as Michael Grandage, you know, who'd just started, so I was kind of pretty snitty about that. It absolutely changed my life career, because it was the first time I worked with Nick Heitner.
And was it love at first sight?
It was kind of love at first sight, and he became a huge sort of supporter, really.
Yeah.
From there I went to the Royal Exchange with Nick, production of Country Wife that he did, which got me some kind of critical attention.
You gave your Sparkish, I seem to remember.
Mr. Sparkish.
With a very large badge saying, "I am rich."
Yeah, yeah.
Tragic.
And a little crown and a very nice muff.
Yeah. And it was quite a revolutionary approach to
it. Yeah, it was a sort of modern take. It was a kind of combination of the period and modern stuff as well. And was sort of maybe when that first started to become a vogue of mixing up styles. And that led me to the RSC and a show I did at the Old Vic called Too Clever by Half.
And that Too Clever by Half was a bit of a game changer.
Yeah, it was. It was, really. Which was directed by Richard Jones, and it was a sort of nod to Russian expressionist theatre. The set went like that. The floor of the set went like that to a single door at the back. So big, extreme design, brilliant design by Richard Hudson. And my hair went like that. And it was... We're working with a lot of people who worked with Complicité, and so we're coming from a physical theatre world, which was dazzling, you know, and pushed me in a direction of sort of physical work that I wasn't convinced by while we were rehearsing it at all. I thought it was... It was touch and go how it was going to kind of go down. And there was some particular business that I did, which was so extreme And people who saw it sort of still talk about it. So Richard's vision was incredible.
How do you cope with it when somebody might ask you to push the boundaries? Because to a certain extent, you're doing new things here, playing Willy Wonka, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, it's thrilling. And it's to have the opportunity to sort of, to be... one can become, you know, you can become safe, I think, and you can go down a sort of particular avenue that doesn't expose you to those. I'd love to work with Richard again, because he's out there in what he does. It was a very, very thrilling production, and one of the most sort of excitingly theatrical and unsafe things that I've ever done, I suppose.
And it did mean that you had to start clearing your mantelpiece.
I got a prize. Yes, Paul.
Good. No. Yeah. I'd be very proud of it. You should be very proud of it.
Prizes isn't why we do it.
No. But you've got three. And richly deserved. So you moved on very shortly after that. You then went... there's other things between, but I suppose the next big thing is the RSC, a stint at the RSC, and Hamlet.
And doing Too Clever by Half was a piece of good fortune, because it sandwiched between the shows I was doing at Stratford and those shows coming into London. So mm-hmm. I was incredibly fortunate that happened.
You are a bit of a Peter Pan, and Hamlet came along... when you were 40?
Yeah, when I was 1997, and I didn't think I would... I thought nobody would ever ask me to do that. And Matthew Waters did, and we both had similar... I responded to his thoughts about the play, of cutting it and doing it in modern dress, which was a huge... you know, I couldn't have done Hamlet in a blouse and tights. You know. I would not have believed it, and neither would anybody else.
And you also, was that the same time as you did Peer Gynt?
Peer Gynt was a bit earlier than that.
Okay. And Peer Gynt was with the legend that is John Barton,
yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah.
Who was a one-off, wasn't he?
Yeah. John Barton was, you know, for those of you who don't know, one of the kind of founders of the RSC, worked a huge amount with Peter Hall, was an academic, still is an academic. Brilliant, brilliant brain. Extraordinary talks that he does, where he will. He read the Mort d'Arthur to us as a company once, which was an extraordinary thing to have inflicted upon you. Some people didn't respond to it, but it was absolutely mesmerizing, really. And he did it in. What he believes is the correct pronunciation, but he's a dazzling brain, and having the opportunity to do Peer Gynt with him was remarkable, in that he was a man of a certain age. He's in his mid late 80s now. He was 70-ish then, I suppose. His experience, his life, taught me a huge amount, really, and finding a way to play that great monolithic thing.
Yeah. And then...
Hamlet changes you.
Okay. For the better?
I don't know whether for the better or not, but just to wrestle with those words, you know, to have the opportunity to say those words and wrestle with those thoughts is an extraordinary...
If you'd cut a experience. Lot of it, did you get the page turners at Stratford who are trying to follow...
Yeah, you kind of did that, and it really pissed people off a lot that we'd cut. We sort of cut the external politics, so it became about the two families, really.
Yeah.
Focused on that.
There's that wonderful moment when they're following their penguin texts, and you get to a cut, and you pause, and you can hear all the pages turn out there in the audience, and then you carry on while they find where they are. So that was the joy.
I've been on stage with Ian McDiarmid, where he has removed that book from...
Fantastic.
...the person's hand.
Of course, it's very useful. I think sometimes they prompt, though, don't they?
Yes, that might be useful.
Do we see you as much on TV as we should?
No, clearly not.
Okay. Because you are, I suppose you are, no, I mean, you've done an awful lot of theatre and television, but we've come to know you as one of our foremost theatre actors.
Yeah, I've done, you know, I've always done it, but I'm not as confident as I am in front of, as I am on stage in front of a camera.
I think I read something you said that sometimes when you're doing it because it's a bit bitty, that you come away thinking, we haven't really done anything.
Yeah, it can be like that, and it's a different discipline, as I'm sure, you know, people in this room know. And I admire the people who really, 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 really do work on screen. They may not necessarily work on stage, but I think often it's what you've got here that does something on camera. When I've worked with Helena Bonham Carter, I did The Wings of the Dove with her, and I remember being once the other side of the monitor and watching what was, and Helena was fantastic in The Wings of the Dove, wonderful performance, and seeing what happened. Something magical, sort of, the camera picks up, which is to do with her talent as well, but to do with what her face does. And not everybody's going to have that.
Yeah. So let me pick up on Nick Heitner now, because a lot of the fantastic theatre stuff you've done, certainly in the last 10 years, has been at the National.
Mm.
Have you got a favourite when you look back? Have you got a highlight? I mean, you've done an enormous range of stuff there.
I suppose my personal favourite was Nick's production of The Winter's Tale.
Yeah.
When I played Leontes. And he's a very close friend, and I knew I wasn't the first choice. But, you know, we never are. And he put together a bunch of people a lot of us had worked together before in various combinations. There was Julian Waterman, myself and Claire Skinner and Debbie Finley. Wonderful bunch of people who all had sort of interweaved at some point in their careers. And the people we were playing have arrived at a particular point in their lives. Myself and Julian Wadham were both relatively new parents. Claire Skinner, in fact, became pregnant during the... Well, not during the production, but you know what I mean.
I was going to say, it's taking a bit far.
And the play is about children. And it's such a magical and extraordinary play. Incredible play.
And, of course, we do associate you a lot from that stint at the National with Alan Bennett.
Yeah, because I got to do... and the other thing was playing Lord Foppington, which sort of goes back to Donald Sinden, because Donald Sinden had been a very, very famous and brilliant Lord Foppington at Stratford in the 60s. And Donald came to see it, in fact. And Trevor Nunn directed it. I had a ball. I had, you know, the wigs, the beauty spots, the makeup, the extraordinary costumes by Sue Blaine. And Trevor just kept pushing me too. So I had an intrusive R, I had a lisp. I can't have an intrusive R. Is it an intrusive R?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. I had the lot. I said, I can't have that as well. He said, yes, you can. So just kept pushing me to go further with this creation. And lots of business and stuff, particular physical business. And Donald came to see it and was very, very sweet about it and discussed business. And he said, yes, I did that. So Trevor had given me all Donald's business and made me think like it was mine.
I suppose that's his gift, isn't it, really?
Well, it is, really, because it's quite, you know, it's okay to steal from people.
Yeah.
We do
nothing
it all the time.
Borrow all the time. So,
yeah, and then I did The Habit of Art that Alan wrote.
Yeah.
And then got to play him in the two little short
Across
pieces.
The Road.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're going to be playing him again?
I am.
Is that those two plays going on
no,
film?
No, it's a film of The Lady in the Van.
Okay.
Yeah. The Lady in the Van, which is the story about the vagrant lady who Alan allowed into his driveway in her...
Miss Shepherd.
Miss Shepherd, yeah. And she stayed for 15 years.
And are they having two versions of him as they do in the play?
Yeah, or in the play, there are two Alan Bennetts. In the film, there are two who were played by Kevin, two different actors. And in the film, there are two different Alan Bennetts, and they're both played by me.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, so it's a bit quite scary.
Okay. And so that was your last stint in the West End down the road before coming back up here?
Yeah.
And you were here in My Fair Lady?
Yeah, yeah.
What's it like coming into a building like this? Because you can't walk into that auditorium down there without being affected by it. And, you know, you spent a lot of time at the National, which has its own particular charm in style. And then you come back here to probably one of the grandest auditoriums we've got.
Yes, and... It's a beautiful theatre to play. It's pretty frightening when you first step out on that stage. And when I took over from Jonathan Price in My Fair Lady, I'd never done a musical before, and Jonathan finished on the Saturday night, and I was on the Monday. You know, we'd had rehearsals, but taking over is quite an odd process because you're going into something that already exists and decisions have been made without you being a part of them, and you hopefully make it your own, but you've missed out on a lot of the process.
Yeah, because these shows and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is an enormous machine of a show, and I saw it last year when it opened, and then I came to see you last week, and it's like there's this big ride going, and everybody else got on before it started and got up to speed. And you had to step on.
Yeah, yeah. There were about, you know, I was in the company of about half of new people in the show when I came into it. So you're not alone. And you're incredibly well looked after, and it's an extraordinary machine that gets it out there, as it was with My Fair Lady. And that particularly was a dream job because it's such a flawless piece. And a great acting part as well.
Now, I walked across the stage last Monday night from the stage door to come to your little bachelor apartment.
You get a nice dressing room as well.
And it's a fantastic theatre, but it's a bit, you get the chills. And my research tells me that you slept here.
I did sleep here. One night where I was, you get enforced holidays in musicals. Which I really, when I did Higgins, I really didn't want to take at all, because I didn't want anybody else to play my part. And in fact, Malcolm Sinclair, our president, equity president, was playing Colonel Pickering. And my first holiday, I hated it. I hated handing it over to somebody else. And I just got a text from Malcolm after the first performance of my cover. Well, he's a revelation. that was it. I did stay here because I was going on holiday and was getting a really early flight. So I said, can I stay in my dressing room? And you're not kind of meant to. But they said I could. And walked across the stage at sort of 4 o'clock in the morning. And it was spooky, actually. People say, I don't believe in all of that. But it was very strange. Very strange atmospheres to do with the cavernous space and
benevolent, strange.
I didn't want to look.
Okay, a bit like Doctor Who.
And I'm not easily spooked, but I walked across and I didn't want to look into the auditorium. It's rubbish. But it's a thrilling space to play as well.
And how is it? Because this is your second musical now, but you've extended the boundaries even more because you dance in Charlie
dance.
And Chocolate.
I dance a bit at Higgins, but kind of waltz dancing, you know.
But you do proper dancing.
I do, yeah, mostly.
Okay.
A bit of tap. My advanced age.
Is it a joy to do this show?
Yeah, it is a joy, actually. It's a complete joy, and it's really taken me by surprise how... what a treat it is. Fantastic company. The kids are all delightful. Genuinely. There's no little horrors at all. It's a big present, really. It's taxing for me because it's challenging me in areas that I'm not so comfortable in, like singing and tap dancing.
Uh-huh. So have you been back and taken? Have you worked with people in order to do that?
Yeah, we're monitored. I mean, the team who kind of keep an eye on the show, the dance team and the musical singing side of things, keep a very stern eye. It's incredibly well monitored. And prior to starting rehearsals proper, they put me with a brilliant singing teacher called Mary King, who was fantastic. You know, he's a proper posh classical singer, and I'm not being disingenuous, but I'm not making any great claims for the quality of the sound I make. But she really kind of brought me on, and I'm doing sort of proper joined up notes.
It's fantastic to watch it and then see lots of people for whom I suppose it might be their first experience of theatre. Mm. And you go back to the shows you were talking about you saw, and certainly my first experience to come and see something, that some you have that special responsibility that some of those people who are watching you may get the germ.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, and families coming together. How the fuck they afford it, I do not know. But, you know, families come and see the show, and it's potentially a treat for them. So, you know, it is a big responsibility, and not to be sort of taken lightly. You have to take it seriously as well, and not, you know, muck about when you're in a show for a long time.
I should just point out there are lots of reasonably priced offers available from really useful theatres to see Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh, yeah.
As I can see several members of the executive sitting at the back, but it's well worth it, whatever you pay. It is the most fantastic experience. I always think of you as a bit of a sort of... You're a bit of a sort of English Cary Grant, aren't you, really? Would you have liked to have been that sort of...
Liked to have been Cary Grant, yeah.
Or James Stewart.
Cary Grant said he wanted to be Cary Grant.
Those screwball comedies, you know.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah. And I grew up watching... All those movies when I was growing up used to be on television. You know, not on... We only had four channels. Black and white movies and world cinema they used to be. So that was absolutely my food. And that period, that golden period of Hollywood is, you know... That's where I wanted to be Fred Astaire, really.
Fantastic. The good thing about doing these and talking to people who I know is that I can go and use Wikipedia and Google and find out things I didn't know. And you said earlier you don't know what you'd have been if you hadn't been an actor. Somewhere you said to somebody you think you'd quite like to have been an archivist because you quite like collecting and hoarding.
Yeah, I'm a terrible hoarder of stuff. And I'm a bit of a sort of showbiz anorak and write articles for the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography on dead actors.
Oh, interesting.
You have to be dead to be in the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, which was a big tome that was started by Virginia Woolf's father, as stop me if I go on, at the end of the 19th century. And I also get sent lists of the recently deceased and have to grade them.
Oh, really?
Which Simon Russell Beale is very nervous about. So you're fine. So I do a bit... that's the only kind of writing that I do.
Do you enjoy that?
Yeah, I do enjoy it. I do enjoy it. And feel a sort of... And it's quite an oddly intimate thing because they have access to birth, death and marriage certificates. So you get all that stuff sent to you, which is quite... a sort of privileged look into somebody's life.
How fantastic!
Yeah, I'm very interested, and I think it's something that where we come from, where we've evolved from, and I don't want those people to be sort of forgotten, really.
Lovely.
I want people to, you know, go and watch Paul Scofield.
All the people you saw when you were growing up.
Yeah.
Now, the good thing about sitting in this chair is that I only have to do half the work. Because while you still have to keep your brain intact, we're going to hand over to the audience now. So we're going to go through that horrendously embarrassing moment when I say, what questions are there?
There aren't any.
And we look at a sea of silence. But we are upping the technology stakes. We've got the lovely Heather there, who's got a roving mic. So even more commitment. But if you do have a question for Alex, can you just give us a wave? Right down the front, you're fantastic. And that means, Heather, you have to get right down here. But look, straight in.
Very good.
Thank you. Oh, you'll hold it. Okay. Is it working? Okay, great. Several years ago, when you did one of these in conversations, I talked to you about playing Professor Harold Hill. And at that time, you said, oh, no, I'm too old for that. I do not think you're too old. The Music Man has not had a revival in a long time, and you should do it.
Well, thank you. I would love to do it. If anybody here wants to put it on, I'm available in April. I would love to. And, I'm aware that it's kind of limited what I can do in musical theatre. But that is, you know, I'd love to have a go at that. Thank you.
Brilliant. How nice of you to invite your agent along. Yeah. Next, give us a wave, wherever you are, and you will be attacked with a lovely microphone, which you may or may not hold. I think they've got others, so...
Hi, I'm Joanna. From what you've been telling us, it sounds like you've never been out of work. But if you were, what was your process for surviving that until the next job came along?
I have been. I've been pretty fortunate. I'm crap at it. And I can remember finding the Actors' Centre very useful at a certain point in my career of a place to go and to do classes. I need sort of prodding and I'm quite lazy, but I don't really have a process and I'm not very good at it at all. Incredibly impressed, having worked a bit in musical theatre land, of the folk who really make that show work, the people in the chorus, the people who are playing the smaller parts, who, because there are sort of dividing lines which shouldn't be there in our profession, who don't get opportunities because they've got such fantastic skills, they go from musical to musical, their work ethic and their how they keep their machine functioning, because they can really sing, they can really dance, so that you have to work at those things. I'm kind of dazzled by their determination and their work ethic, really.
How do you cope with people saying no to you?
Saying no,
you haven't got a job. No, because resilience is an incredible part of any actor's career.
It's really hard, you know. It's and that doesn't stop.
No.
You know, and being given this opportunity here is, it's a year's work. You think, thank God, I'm all right for a year. So that doesn't stop.
Yeah. Do you have rage? Does that rage come
really
out?
Have,
or are you?
Yes, I do have rage.
Did you?
Yeah, I kind of, you know, sit and spit at the television. And there was a period where I was trundling along. And things weren't moving. And, you know, I saw yet another Merchant Ivory movie that I wasn't in. So that was annoying.
Let's go back out to the audience. Anybody else? Next question. Wherever it is. There we are in the centre, and then we'll come down to you. Lovely. Thank you, Heather.
Who is your favourite director to work with and why?
Oh, blimey. I haven't really got a favourite, and it's sort of been tied in. Nick has absolutely been the sort of the core in my career, because he's given me
so many opportunities. And clearly, I like working with him. But there are others who, because it's tied in with a particular production that's been that has fed me, has been a great experience. Matthew Warchus doing Hamlet. So it's kind of tied in with those experiences. I've had negative ones as well, but not that many, really. And I've been fortunate to work with a huge variety of directors. Stephen Frears on The Queen. Fantastically supportive, which was a weird one to do, you know, playing Prince Charles. And there was a particular, there was a scene that we filmed, for those of you who haven't, you know the story, when Charles comes back with, on the aeroplane from Paris, and with the body of Diana, and was met on the by Tony Blair and a phalanx of people, and filming that scene. And we did my shots first thing in the morning, and then turned around onto Michael Sheen as Tony Blair and did those. And Stephen came up to me and said, do you want to have another go? And he was prepared. And I said, well, oh, fuck, why was it so terrible? No, it wasn't terrible. He said, but I can see that you've moved on during the day. You've arrived at something during the day. And he was prepared to turn the crew round again to give me another opportunity. And I really thank and respect him for that. And he's some, you know, so he cares. He's and he's looking after you as yeah. well.
What do directors do in rehearsal rooms that make you give of your best? What's the input that you love to get?
Allow you to experiment and to make an ass of yourself, really, and yeah. to play and not to sit on that. And I've worked with the odd director who has sat on that. And that's a very depressing sort of, what's the point, really? And allows you to bring stuff and then suggests and hones and moulds and gives you Donald Sinden's old business.
Which you're very grateful for.
I'm very grateful.
This lady down the front had a question. Thank you very much.
I was just wondering if you'd ever considered directing or producing yourself.
No, I haven't. I did a little tiny bit of directing at university, but I'm not, absolutely not interested, and know that I don't have those people management skills. Not all directors do either, but no, I couldn't do that. So I'm not... No. Pretty confident that that's not something I will ever do.
Are you a live in the role type of person, or are you a get on and do it sort of guy?
I'm get on and do it. But I'm allowed to be exhausted at home, you know.
That's good.
Or not always allowed, but, you know.
Are there any little Jennings going to follow your footsteps?
No, happily.
Good. You're happy with that?
I mean, I wouldn't have dissuaded them, but, you know, I'm very pleased that they've gone in different directions.
Good. Okay, time for the next... There we are. Look, they're making you work, Heather, you see, by a cunning plan of hands going up at opposite ends of the room in concert.
Hi. I just wanted to ask, you've mentioned about your sort of experiences in television, or British television at least. With the success of particular British actors over in the States, we saw this golden period of television that's happening over there, and I suppose to a certain degree over here. I mean, would you ever consider going over to the States to do a series, you know, like a True Detective or a Breaking Bad, one of those sorts of shows which really encompasses a well-known or experienced British actor such as yourself?
I would absolutely now be up for trying that out. Now my kids are not at home. I would be absolutely up for giving that a go. I did once after I played, when I played Hamlet with the RSC, it went to Washington and New York, and I went out and sat in LA for a bit and actually did a job, a Civil War, American Civil War TV movie. About the first time they ever used submersibles in the American Civil War, and the engineer was Scottish, so that's how I came to be in that, and spent a bit more time in LA, kind of waiting for something to happen, and felt myself sort of going backwards and getting depressed, really, that any sort of heat there'd been about having just played Hamlet for the RSC meant fuck all in LA. And I was sort of going up for, and you're going for meet, you know, going for meeting. It was funny, and going for meetings at Disney Studios, and just loving it that you go to this. I think it's Frank Gehry, this amazing building that's held up by the Seven Dwarves. So that appealed to me. But I went for, you know, one meeting where I'd been put up by my agent that I briefly had out there to play, and it was to play a kind of gang member in some Chicago-based gangster movie.
I mean, you come from Essex, that shouldn't be a stretch.
Well, indeed, you know, and I thought, this is a long shot, isn't it? And they said, yeah, it is a long shot, but, you know, give it a go. But I thought, no, this is sort of stupid, really. So I didn't give it my full attention, really. So I ran away.
So if the phone does ring with this offer from America, what is it in your mind? Is it a nice sitcom? Is it a serial killer? Is it Homeland 3? Forget Homeland 3. Something original, obviously. But, you know, is there something...
Well, I'd love to think that...
Is there something on the bucket list?
You know, I could do one of those things.
Is there something on the bucket list that's waiting?
No, I've never had a bucket list.
Okay.
But the Hugh Laurie thing is quite attractive, isn't it?
Yes, evidently, in all sorts of ways, financially and...
But you have to be realistic as well about what number you are on the list.
Yeah. And it's a big impact because I suppose it means going to America for 8 months of the year and you have a family and...
Yeah, which is absolutely one of the reasons why I've not done that. And I've been given fantastic parts to play in theatre over here, which I would not have missed for any of that. The opportunities I've had in the theatre here.
Brilliant. Okay, so Heather's at the back, so I'm going to guess there's another hand going to come down the front. No, they're being very nice to you, keeping you right where you are.
This is a slightly selfish question, but could you just talk a bit about Midsummer Night's Dream, the Trevor Nunn production?
Midsummer Night's Dream?
Yeah.
Adrian Noble.
Adrian?
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's all right. Yeah, I did the production of Midsummer Night's Dream at Stratford, which was Light Bulbs and Umbrellas. Did you see it?
Yeah.
You on stage?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a very, very sort of magical thing to be involved with. It was an amazing cast in Stratford. Stella Gonne was Titania, Finbar Lynch was Park, Des Barrett. The lovers were Hayden Gwynn, Emma Fielding, Kevin Doyle and Toby Stevens. And it was an amazing company. And Adrian kind of hit on something, I think sort of influenced by the Peter Brook one, probably. You know, there was the Bower was a umbrella, that feathery umbrella that came down. And you were, it was a long time ago now, but one was aware pretty early on that it became a bit of an event and was a very popular production. And that was thrilling to be involved with. We then made a film of it, which was less thrilling. Because I don't think necessarily something you do on stage is going to work on film. And then took it to America. So I was with it for a long time. I had a very big train that I kicked a lot.
I remember.
Yeah.
And you've done how many stints in Stratford? Three?
No, four or five, I think.
And does that appeal? Because it is a bit cloistered, isn't it? It's a bit, you know, theatrical academia, that it's all centres about the work, and for some poor actors, you can open your door and there is the theatre across the road.
Yeah, but that's rather wonderful for a while.
You like that?
Yeah, I did. I did. I had fantastic times there, and I couldn't believe that I was being given the opportunity to play Hamlet with him buried down the river.
Yeah.
And being with a company and working on several plays together as a company, which I know they're trying, you know, they've resurrected there, is a wonderful way to work. And I've not done that since then, really.
Yeah.
And to work with Sis Berry at Stratford, and to get a bit of her and what she sort of accesses you and how she sort of tunes into the person you are and gets you to connect with the words.
How different is the culture then at the National, where I suppose most people, when they've finished, having had their post-performance drink or two, then go home?
Yeah, it is very different at Stratford, and can be very kind of bad and out of control. But yeah. I never did that.
Okay.
So I was a responsible new father.
Good to hear.
But, you know, that's all, it's all good fun, isn't it?
Let's take... there's one more there. Brilliant. Down the front, and then there's one at the back. And then I think we'll probably be having to say thank you. Just down here.
Hello. One of the most entertaining evenings I've ever had in the theatre was when I saw Present Laughter at the National. I really enjoyed it. When I've spoken to other people about it, they say they hadn't enjoyed it quite as much.
Yeah.
For some reason, it really stayed with me, and I really loved it. I saw it a couple of times. I'm just wondering how that experience was for you.
That experience of playing Gary Essendine in Present Laughter, you know, great part, lots of dressing gowns, swanning around for quite a long, 3 hours I think it is, it's a long play. I don't think we were terribly helped by some aspects of the set. It was a very kind of, and when I saw the model I said, oh, where's that flat? It was pretty extreme architecturally, and was very, very green. I don't know whether you remember that. I'm not blaming this. I'm not blaming the set. And also, I think there were Howard Davis, who's a brilliant director, set it in the phony war. And we started each act with Gary Essendine listening to contemporary radio broadcasts of what was going on in Europe, which is then never referred to in the play, and was a bit of a sort of downer, really, I think. And I think we struggled to get over that, and it was something that was not then bled into the production, perhaps. And I think people took against that.
Well, not everybody.
No. Yeah, I don't know what else to say about Present Laughter, really.
Well, you have a fan. One person loved it, at least. There was a hand going up there.
You were the person laughing.
Hey, there he is. You see, yes, he was the person laughing. And I think this will probably be our last question, so no pressure.
Hello. How important at the beginning of your career was work that you generated yourself in comparison to work that you were put up by your agent, or even later on?
How important was generating work for myself kind of at the start? Very, I would say. And we had sort of lessons at drama school on, you know, how to write letters and just pumping them out to everybody. I assume that still happens. And there was that, what's that trade magazine called?
Contacts?
Contacts?
The one with all the addresses or the one that gives you the casting information?
The one that gives you the casting information.
There are loads now, and they're all digital.
Right.
Okay. We've come away from the quill pen, wherever. Out in Essex, it may still be the quill pen. We have moved away from it. We now have digital casting information and Spotlight and CastWeb and Casting Networks and Casting Call Pro.
Right.
So there's a lot out there, but how valid it is, we don't know.
And not easy to monitor that, of how...
I think it's easy to monitor. I'm not sure how easy it is to monitor the quality of the information.
Right.
Because sometimes the stars in one person's eyes are the pound signs in somebody else. So some of these are not casting companies. They're software companies who are just selling information.
Right.
So it can be really difficult for actors to... And I know people we've had talking at the Actors' Centre. It can be really difficult if you're alone... to sort out what information is worthwhile, and of course they charge.
Right.
Information is money.
Yeah. So it was incredibly important to do it yourself, really, and just keep bombarding people and not get depressed by, try not to get depressed by rejections or, and you know, not letters not being answered. So it was important and. Have arrived at a position, I suppose, where I don't have to do so much of that. But film and TV doesn't necessarily land on my lap. You still have to, you know, go on. You do it yourself now, don't you?
Yeah.
I've not managed to master that. At all.
Well, it's a good job they're keeping you busy here for a year.
Indeed.
But you are taking a little bit of time out to do the Alan Bennett Lady in the Van.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
But you'll be on at half term.
I'll be on at half term.
Everybody who wants to bring children.
Yeah, and then back in December.
Fab, okay. He's a lovely man to spend an hour with. We haven't done this for many years.
Sure.
When we were boys together, one matinee of a show we were doing, Alex had all his money stolen. And because we all loved him so much, we had a collection and we raised 19 shillings. And we left it in his dressing room and he went out straight away with sixpence and bought a card, which he put up on the green room notice board to express his gratitude. And I read it, or rather I misread it, and I stormed up to his dressing room and knocked on the door and went, "Oi, posh boy, what do you mean?" Because I'd read the card as saying thank you. It isn't enough, but thank you. And he took me downstairs to the green room and he opened the card and pointed out what he'd actually written, which was saying thank you isn't enough, but thank you. So saying thank you isn't enough, but thank you for joining us
thank
today.
You.